All right, everybody, we're back here with another episode of Trail Talk. Today we're out with Michael Lee, local yokel here, local racer. We're going to go run Double Sammy, talk about how he got into this stuff, and kind of go from there. I wanted to ask you, how does an Alabama boy end up out here in Utah racing juiced up golf carts across the desert?
Oh, man, we've been coming out to Johnson Valley and just the Vegas area, do a lot of racing since, I guess, 2016. Okay. And after we leave King of the Hammers, we would always stop by. And, like, just coming through here and just visit and spend a couple of days riding and just checking out the area. Then I had a couple friends that moved out as well, and they were kind of pushing me a little bit, man, you're missing out. But, yeah, once we sold our house, we just kind of looked for the next step in life, and we just said, we love it here, and I'm spending a lot more time in the Vegas area, so we don't want to live in Vegas, and no. We love it here, so we just started looking. We made a good trip out here just to look around and see where we wanted to live, and we took a leap of faith and said, if it doesn't work out, we can move back, you know? You we'll can always go out. Back. Yeah, but so we just... We took a leap of faith, and we made it out here, and it's honestly, the transition hasn't been bad at all for us, really? Which is nice. Yeah, it's just our lifestyle. It's everything that we want to be out here.
Yeah.
Between bike riding and off-roading and the lake right here in our backyard, it's everything we like to do is right here. So
yeah, for sure. Well, we can get after this trail, and I got to ask you, so you said you've been doing King of Hammers since 16, so you've been doing off-roading probably from before that. You don't usually start and be like, oh yeah, this is my first year in an off-road vehicle, let me go out to Johnson Valley, see what happens. How'd you get into it?
That's actually a funny story that not many people really know the truth behind. I was really big into cars, and I still am, drag racing and road racing and drifting. And we got we were out and about one night at like a car meet or something, and I'm 15 years old at this time.
Yeah.
And it rained.
Okay.
And so we couldn't do anything that night. We couldn't go to the track. We couldn't race. And I was like, man, this kind of sucks. And so my friend went and met up with some other guys, and they all had Jeeps.
Okay.
And they were like, hey, we're going off-road. And I'm like, what? This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. And, we've done dirt bikes and four-wheelers and stuff, of course, but I was like, this is going to be ridiculous. But it was, like, one of the most fun nights I've ever had. We would just went mud riding back in Alabama, so
yeah.
It was nothing like this, like we're rock crawling. And that was it, man. I was like, this is insane. And I had a car picked out that I was about to buy, and I just everything changed right there. So I bought a Grand Cherokee, and it just took off from there. So I just started build it myself. I didn't have a ton of money, obviously, and so we just kind of kept it simple. And I joined all the local Jeep clubs and riding clubs and was real active in them all, helping keep the trails clean and, you know, fight for our rights for getting to ride and whatnot. And then it just kind of evolved, you know. I kind of just jumped back and forth between racing. I did real big into drag racing, sport compact stuff, and we were okay. All over the country. We had some of the fastest Honda motors out there running 8-second quarter miles, 180 miles an hour. We had the fastest H-series car that we built. It was that's a whole other say. But yeah, then we got big into drifting for a minute, road racing, and then we were big into dirt bikes after that. Like, dirt bikes became our life. My daughter actually qualified for Loretta Lynn's.
Oh, really?
That's awesome. On 50s. And then while training and stuff, she just kind of said, I don't want to do this anymore. And so we stopped, and then I was like, okay. And we just kept riding dirt bikes. I was racing all over the Southeast. And then a buddy of mine came to me. We were still doing Jeep stuff. I was helping a guy after work. We were still doing Jeep stuff, too. And the guy I was helping out had a fab shop, and he was real big into the Razors, and it was like when the 800s just came out, and he started building roll cages and accessories for them, and I was like, this is a joke. Then he got the 900s, And then the 1000 came out, and I was like, man, this machine's actually pretty nice. I just can't see myself buying one. Anyways, a friend of mine came to me. He was in some financial issues and needed to free up some cash, and I said, yeah, man, I'll take care of you. So I bought an XP 1000 for him, a 2014 model, the very first year. And I bought it for him for $8,500 on a Friday. The next Saturday, or like that was a Friday afternoon, he brought it to my house. Saturday morning, I went to a local off-road park and did a race. First time ever racing a UTV.
And not
I
even won, 24 it, hours into owning it.
Yeah, and I won the sportsman class. It was like a little woods race. Yep. And then I got like third in the pro class. And I was like, oh, okay, we're on to something.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's kind of the involvement of the off-road stuff. It just spiraled downhill in UTVs after that. So, but at the end of the day, I've been a Jeep guy all my life. And I've done crazy, you know, one-ton axle builds under Cherokees, Grand Cherokees. I've had supercharged JKs with one-tons and 42s and, you know, yeah. Cut frame LJs, all of it. So,
yeah, that's kind of interesting. It's funny. I mean, it's not funny, but you started off in like, you know, drag racing and that kind of stuff, and it's like, oh, it rained on the track. It doesn't matter what your track prep's like. You're not hooking up anyway. And all the Jeep guys are like, so no, this is our time. Like, we wait for the mud.
Yeah, that's what it was.
That's freaking cool. But yeah. You got into the Razors through that kind of progression of things. Were you still doing all the Jeep things, all your, you know, one ton builds while you were doing the side by side things, or did you kind of pick it up, run that race, you know, do well and kind of be like, okay, this is where my effort's going now, or?
So I had both I guess I had another one at the time, but the last big Jeep build that I did was an LJ, and I did like a moto built back half on it. I had like one of the first frame kits that where you cut the whole back of the frame off.
Okay.
And so I just finished that, and then I was actually like prepping the car to be a 4500 race car for King of the Hammers. Okay. And so I had the 14 inch coilovers, I had the tires, I had the axles, and I was gonna do a pretty budget build. And so like that was my intention the whole time, was I'm going to race King of the Hammers. But it was just going to be in the Jeep. And then once I got the UTV, I was like, this is a really fun play toy. And then all of a sudden, I was like, well, I'm race ready, you know, with some more safety stuff to get out to King of the Hammers.
Yeah.
And so like, let's just pursue this. And then the guy at Fab Shop I was helping out, he was like, dude, I'll take care of everything. He's like, I'll do a full build for you. He was real big in the industry at the time. Joey Gilbert's his name. He's a good friend of mine still. And he said, let's do it. And so we did some Ultra 4 races, and he built a good little nimble car for me. And I went to my first race, 4 race, at Badlands, Indiana. And okay. Yeah, and I drove up, and I was like, yeah, whatever. Let's just see how I pulled into the parking lot, nervous as could be. I almost turned around. Because there was stacker trailers everywhere, 18-wheelers. And I was like, dude, I'm out of place.
Yeah.
And I was by myself, no co-driver, no support, no pits, no nothing. And Joey called me. He's like, dude, just calm down. Use your dirt bike experience. It's what you do. Just race through the woods. Have fun. And I was like, whatever. Okay. So we go out there, pre-run, do everything, and come out, and I stop at the finish line. It's like a 2-hour race in the woods, and Dave Cole comes up to me and shakes my hand and goes, congratulations, I think you got second. And I'm like, what?
You're like, oh, I'm sure that I didn't turn around. Go
home. Yeah, and he comes back up to me a few minutes later. He's like, confirmed, you got third place. He's like, have you ever raced with us before? I was like, no. He was like, you're the first time a rookie has ever come in here and podium. And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, maybe it was a fluke.
Yeah.
We'll see. And so we went back to Kentucky, Dirty Turtle Off-Road. We went back there. Which way do I normally go? I guess that way. Trying to figure out the best way to go.
Yeah.
I think I'd go this way.
That's fine, probably.
Yeah. So we went to Dirty Turtle in Kentucky just a month later, and all the big names were there again. And, like, Badlands race was not just, like, some Joe Blows. Like, I was on the podium. Yeah. Shannon Campbell won. Eric Diller second. Like,
a bunch of privateers, like actual, yeah, factual people doing it.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So, and then from there, you're just like, I guess this is what we do now.
Yeah, basically. And so we went to the Dirty Turtle race, and we got third again there. I think one of the Gomez brothers got first, and then Sean Hollick got second. So that was a cool experience, though, for real. And then after that, we tore the car apart and said, we're doing King of the Hammers. And so that was the end of it. I mean, I still had my Jeep at the time, just to answer the original question.
Yeah.
And I sold it. I got home and I posted it for sale on Pirate. It sold within a week. And I just used all that money to build a KOH car, basically. Yeah. So
how many side-by-sides have you owned since that original 800?
Oh, man. So I never actually owned an 800. I had the 1000.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So I got the 1000, and then I raced it for 2 years, maybe 3 years. I don't know how it survived. And then I got a turbo, XP turbo, raced it for a year, and then I got a pro. What else did we get? Pro XP? Yeah, Pro XP, first car. It's one of the first ones in the country to have one.
Yeah.
And it was just me and Mitch Guthrie racing one at KOH that year, and I freaking front flipped the car at like 85 miles an hour in the first 16 miles of KOH. So that wasn't fun. So that's
the opposite of your first race experience.
Yeah. And so then I bought a couple Turbo R's. Man, I don't know. I probably had about 10 or 15, I guess, just between buying some here and there and trying to make some extra money flipping some.
Yeah.
But probably a good standard. We do one race car a year.
Yeah.
And so now we're getting to the point, though, where it's, you got to have a race car and a pre-runner or a play car. So
yeah,
it kind of doubles up.
So do you, of all those that you built, is it like every year you like the new car better, or do you have one that you like, I really like that one? Are you really fond of the one you flipped or something to that effect, or is it?
I think you take a lot that you are in the building of the car, and you're like, okay, this is different and this works better, or that didn't work and I didn't like how that worked, you know. But there's never really been something that stood out and said, this is the best car yet.
Yeah.
I think the closest one to that would be the Pro R. When we got it, I actually got offered to race the Pro R the first time I did it. So I didn't even buy that car. And that was a interesting experience, just because I was so used to the turbo cars, obviously,
yeah,
and how the power delivery was and how they handled the rocks and rock crawling, rock racing.
Yep.
And getting in that car, I kind of felt like I was in a Jeep. I kept saying it's like a full size, which it basically is. I mean, my race weight, you know, two people in there, you're 3,000 pounds or so.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think the Pro R stood out more than any of them, though. And it's been kind of cool just to develop that a little bit more. And I think that if you pay attention to the race world, that car has been developed more than anyone, like on the aftermarket side. Like, there's more people building custom tube chassis and, you know, just pushing the envelope with the suspension more. And I think it's been the most developed car thus far, so.
I think overall the Pro chassis cars, everything from the Pro XP up to the Pro R, I think,
yeah,
Polaris really did their homework. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. Well, I thought the Pro XP when it came out was like the ugliest car ever.
Yeah.
And like, still, I think it, yeah, is, with the factory cage and all. Like, even the Pro R's don't look great. But I went to the dealership to buy a Turbo S to build,
yeah,
for a race car. And I got there, and the Pro XP was there. I was like, man, something told me. I was with Polaris at the time already, but something just told me. I said, this is where they're going with this.
Yeah.
The Turbo S is about to be obsolete, so, like, let's get on the forefront of it and get that Pro chassis and start figuring it out. Yeah. And it was a completely new, because we had we could build a Turbo S chassis in a week.
Yeah, you had the process done, and you're like, this is how we knock it out, and just...
Yeah, and we got that Pro XP, it was completely different. I mean, just everything about it was way different. So it was a learning curve. It was a good one, though.
Yeah, to this day, I think the Turbo S 4-seater is the best-looking side-by-side that's ever been made, and I will throw hands with anyone who disagrees.
I agree with you 100%, don't worry.
Yeah, they look so sweet. But it's just everything's come a long way since then. So I've been meaning to ask you. Well, let's get up this a little bit. If you need me to stop asking questions so you can get up something, I'm totally cool to just take it all in for a second, too.
No, this school bus just you gotta maneuver it sometimes. So.
Yeah, 4-seaters. And I ride with a lot of the Jeep guys, and they're like, yeah, we're right at the 110 wheelbase, you know, right on the ticket. And I'm like, yeah, come on, I'm like 15, 16 inches longer, it's fine.
Yeah, and this thing's like the length of a Suburban, so.
Yeah, this is the
even
rock limo.
Yeah, but it does good.
Yep. So, in your experience, so you've been around since 2016 doing off-road racing and stuff like that. So you've been around kind of for the advent of UTVs really coming on the scene and really starting to push in those categories. What has that been like, and how has that kind of been perceived through the broader community from your eyes?
So that's an interesting one, because I was kind of the guy that thought that the UTVs were always dumb. And so I was that guy. And then as soon as I got one, I threw away all my Jeep race plans for KOH and went to a UTV because I saw how capable they were.
Yeah.
Some people kind of live in a, you know, they got their eyes forward. They don't want anything from the outside to affect it. They don't want to, you know, broaden their horizons or open their minds up. Good for you. Like, nobody's hating on you for that. But, like, at the end of the day, technology's crazy and everyone's pushing. And they're pushing the envelope and trying to make what they have better. And I think at the end of the day, it's like so many people were selling their big race cars, whether they were like rock crawlers or rock bouncers or rock racers, desert racers, and going to a UTV, because at the end of the day, you could sell a car for 80 grand and then you go buy one of these, and if you wanted to, finance it at the time for 20 grand, and then you have 80 grand still, you know, to play with to build some crazy race car. But I think it was kind of the tall tale sign for me was looking at it was going, Eric Miller's racing these. I look up at that guy a lot. I'm like, Eric Miller's racing these things. Shannon Campbell's racing these things.
Yeah.
Everybody that is somebody in the off-road racing world is racing a UTV.
Yeah.
But you still have guys that are, you know, all these golf carts are out here. And Dave Cole was even one of them. But he'll be the first to admit, he says, hey, these things aren't golf carts anymore. Man, they're
full
on.
No way.
Yeah, he's like, they're so fast and they're so capable. Now the one thing I didn't ever expect, I think we all kind of dreamed of it, was like, is it going to be a 4400 car? And, you know, everybody got upset that they were allowing golf carts is what they all said, to race in 4400 the last couple of years. And I was like, dude, this is awesome. Push the sport. Push the envelope. They're never going to compete, I didn't think. But guess what?
Well, I think Kyle Chaney has something to say about that.
Yeah, exactly. Chaney comes in there, and he's like, well, I'm going to go ahead and just show you what's up. So I think it's kind of cool. I think they've earned a lot of respect. The envelope's been pushed by the manufacturers and obviously by the aftermarket industry and the racers themselves. There's been a lot of guys that have left full-size stuff and just focused on UTVs, and I think it's been the key to developing a solid platform and a UTV as a whole. So
can you explain, along with that whole, like, oh, they're letting golf carts into the 4400 thing, there was, if I'm not mistaken, a little controversy around, like, cutting the course or being able to go around certain parts of the course. Is that, I don't understand that fully. Is that something you have some insight into? You can kind of walk me through?
Yeah, so every single year at the driver's meeting at KOH, the question comes, how far off course can we go?
Okay.
So, and Dave always says, run the race course.
Perfect.
I think the rule book says you get 150 feet off either side, like in the desert. But if you're in the rocks, stay in the canyon is supposed to be the key.
Okay.
So they've done virtual checkpoints. They call them VCPs. They started doing that. And Dave did it, and like, it caused so much controversy because many people missed them. And then it was a question of, is it picking up my car?
Right.
If the checkpoint's to my left, 10 feet, am I being picked up? Like, in this position right here, like, the checkpoint's right there, I'm on the trail.
Yeah.
Is it picking me up? And so there was a lot of question, but they've been proven to be reliable. But in that scenario, I knew exactly where it was, and like, yeah, he cut the course, but on the map, like, if you pulled it up on your GPS, it looks like you're going up the trail.
Okay.
So he had a rock trail, and then he had a bypass, and they're literally next to each other. So it's kind of hard to say, well, what, like, I can promise you for one thing, for me, in the rock race, I wasn't going on the rock trail.
Yeah.
There's not a VCP in there, so I'm not going to do
you're
it.
You're in the canyon.
Yeah.
And you're all racing, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
If you don't want it to be a thing, you need to explicitly have a rule against that.
Exactly. And so the checkpoint, I think, was at the beginning of that entrance or at the very end of it, and so you had to kind of be off to the left to hit it. And so there was a lot of, you know, discrepancy of did he hit it, did he not? And every single year at KOH, the question is how far can we go off course? Are the bypasses open? And so in the last 4 years, probably, Dave just says the bypasses are open.
Yeah.
Now, if there is, for the 4,400 cars, if there is on their third lap, they have VCPs that they have to hit. And so the bypasses are open until you get to your third lap, but then you race into VCP, VCP. So you don't necessarily even have to run the canyon as long as you're hitting the VCPs.
As long as you tag up with those points.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, to me that sounds like if you need the rules changed, then you need the rules changed and not so much a... Like, okay, so everything that has happened in NASCAR, you probably know this as well, all of the rules come from people pushing the boundaries. Right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, restrictor plates, everything, that's just part of it as the sport evolves. And I don't want to, like, ruffle any feathers with that, but to me, that sounds like you need a rule book change, and that's what
yeah.
it is.
Yeah. Well, I think at the end of the day, they wanted to keep the sport a little, like, alive a little bit of the fact of, like, you know, this is open desert racing. You have
yeah.
this navigation, a little bit of a freedom to decide your own path. And then as the cars got faster and the competition got more stout, it changed rapidly.
Yeah.
And it went to real quick to how can I get faster? How much of the course can I bypass? And all of that stuff. So
yeah.
Sorry, I got to like set up for this.
No, you're okay. I am actually watching you because I do the same kind of BS. Not BS, but like the same. This is kind of a tricky little obstacle. If you can't just pull that, especially in a long car with a breakover angel, this is kind of a fun little.
Yeah, you got to kind of stand her up a little bit.
Yep.
They had a great angle.
We can reset. We're not racing here.
Oh, no. It's like if you get it right, though, the first time, it just walks right up it. But
yep.
There's definitely a little bit of a walk where you got to do first.
Yep. Along that same lines, do you ever catch any hate for being a UTV driver out there? Or is everybody pretty much just like, well, we're just focused on ourselves until it comes down to things like the rule books?
You know, I think that when you're pre-running, you kind of get a little bit of, here comes the UTV.
Yeah.
But I think that it's kind of gone away. Like, I don't know. Like, there's still hardcore guys out there that are in the full size in the 4,400, and they're like, get this UTV out of the course. And that means they're pre-running too. Like, so I just give them all the respect in the world. If they're coming and they're moving faster, I'm going to get out of the way and let them go. You know, just try and avoid any type of conflict. But at the end of the day, like, it's my King of the Hammers. It's my race also. Like,
yeah.
as much as it's theirs, like, I'm there enjoying the land and the race and my experience as well. So I'm not going to cause any conflict, obviously, but nobody's ever really said anything, but you kind of get a little stink eye every once in a while, and they're like, hey, man.
Well, I think that's just kind of the overall, like, I'm going to shut up for a second. We'll let you get out.
No, you're good.
I
was trying to The best line there.
You're climbing in the back now.
Yeah.
So you should feel it come back down, and you're going to, yeah, there we go.
Yeah, he's got to have that right angle.
There it is. That's interesting you have that kind of interaction, but, you know, there's also, I don't know if so many people are, like, mad about it as much as it is, but you still have the guys that are like, no, I'm going to be solid Axel for always and ever.
Right.
And that's just like, well, okay, but
yeah,
we have some pretty strong evidence against that forever. And I'll be honest, I was solid Axel forever guy for a long time.
Oh, yeah, me too. You know, and I think that, like, let me just recorrect myself a little bit. Like, no one's ever, like, screw you, golf cart guy, you know? But,
yeah.
And I think that the respect comes a long way. Like, I remember going through one, I was just, like, trying to, like, just get fast through one rock section. Just, like, I had my line picked up. I'm not sure if it was qualifying or something. And I came through there to scoot. And a full-size guy was right there, and he was like, I've never seen a UTV do that. I didn't know they were capable of doing that. So it's kind of like UTVs can get a bad rap from everyone that's able to go purchase them, and they don't know the off-road respect that needs to be handed out, you know, trail courtesy and anything in between. And so I think they get a bad rap that way. But from a racer's perspective, like, dude, I can go hop in a 4400 car. I race trophy trucks too. So, like, yeah. I know what full-size courtesy is, and, like, you know, you got to watch out for everybody on the trail or the race course. So,
yeah, if you're racing 4400 series stuff, there's a good chance you're not the average dude that just walked down to the dealership.
Right. And that's what everybody was afraid of. They're like, "Oh, we're going to have $50,000 golf carts racing in a 4400 class with a $500,000 cars." That's not the case. Like, Cheney's cars, it's a $150,000 car. Yeah. And, like, his new car and, like, the Miller brothers' new car, like, those things are, they're $300,000 cars that they're racing this year. Like, everyone's gonna be blown away by them.
Well, even, like, yours, like, I don't know what you have into it. I'm sure you have a lot, but, like, you got a new turbo or a new Pro R. And it's just like, well, everything comes off. Like, we're just stripping it down. And it's not like it's any less effort, per se. I mean, the big cars, you know, the 4400 cars, they still have their template kind of things that they follow in their tuning. And I don't know that there's, I mean, at this point, there's not that much difference between picking up a Pro R chassis, and you're still stripping everything down to nuts and bolts, figuring out what works, making it happen. I mean, the difference is you can buy a better base platform, but it's, I don't know, I don't think it dilutes the sport at all. I think it's incredibly opening, and we need more people in this than we have, if you ask me.
Oh, I agree.
So
I agree.
To me, it's all good. I like having more people enjoying what I enjoy, because then I have a stronger community to protect what I enjoy.
And no doubt. So, but it's, I don't know, it's weird out there, you know, people want to pick at it that way, but at the end of the day, I think sometimes, like, they just get jealous too, you know, it's like, man, this UTV just did what I did, but you can't come, you talked about a crawler out here, there's some guys that try, but dude, you can't compare to a boot buggy out here, you know, there's just no way.
The rear steer guys out here, like, I remember talking with Rich. He said, just because a vehicle is faster doesn't mean it's more capable.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
That's 100% how I feel about the Jeeps. Because let's be honest, if you're in the rocks and getting twisted up, you want a solid axle. You want one tons. Like, that's just the reality. If you don't have a requirement for, I have to get through this course in a certain amount of time, and if it breaks, it breaks. We try not to. A solid axle is definitely the way to go. And, you know, there is something to be said for the heritage of the Jeep thing. But I'm really excited to see the UTVs come in, and I'm excited for the opportunity that other people have. That, you know, some people just don't have time to sit down and build a car. Like, I'm sorry, they just don't. Or build a Jeep. And so to have access to trails and stuff through going to a Polaris dealership, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think it just becomes with education too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you see somebody new on the trail that doesn't know, like, don't be an asshole to them at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta be respectful and, you know, at the end of the day, you gotta remember, we were all there at one point. We might have been 10 years old, but, you know, some people that have done this all their life, but we've all been there at some point. We were all the new guy on the scene. And, you know, we all had a lot to learn from day one. So, there's so many more people that are able to get into it a lot easier. And I think you just have to respect that and, make sure that we're doing our part as enthusiasts and racers or, you know, just veterans of the sport to make sure that we're taking care of those people.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
not to kind of circle back, but a little bit, what differences do you see in the off-road community back east versus out here? And not just along the lines of like, well, back there is a lot more mud. But like, is there any differences in the community, the types of people, anything like that? Or is it all, you know, I think to some degree, it's all, we're just out here trying to enjoy the outdoors, but.
Yeah, no, there's definitely some differences. There's a lot more like short climbs. Like you'll be just trail right through the woods and then you'll have like a short, maybe 50 yard hill. It's kind of steep with rock ledges and stuff, and it's super wet out there, so it makes it hard to climb some of that stuff. So there's a difference in that. The builds are a lot different. They're just kind of more built like with the rock bouncer mentality, I would say.
Yeah.
And that's one side of it. And then a lot of guys don't want to just go to Windrock or Brimstone, or the Hatfield and McCoy trails in West Virginia and just go trail ride like we do out here in the desert. So you're going to get a mixture of people, and those guys just kind of build similar cars to like what we would build for a desert car. They have all the right supplies and spare parts and storage and coolers and all that, good audio systems. And those cars are pretty cool, but they're not rock crawling.
Right.
They're literally just blazing trails, camping sometimes along the way, kind of doing that. And just out for a good ride with their friends or their family. So you kind of have two mixtures of people. You have the people that just want to go out and have a leisure trail ride in like those Windrock, Tennessee. Like it's going to be busy every Saturday, Sunday with those people. And then you have the guys that are hardcore trail riders. And, it's almost like the equivalent of like, you know, like Braden out here when he's out riding or something, to Parley, Justin.
Yeah.
And even me sometimes, like we go out there and we're just like, let's find the gnarliest thing we can hit. If we roll over, we roll over. You know, it's just kind of that way, but we go to a park out there, and man, if you're with a good group of people, you can experience 10 to 15 rollovers in one night.
Okay.
Like just people backflipping off stuff. And just, I mean, it just depends on the group you're with, though. So the differences are a lot more of the hit it with speed, momentum, rock bouncer mentality on the hardcore crawling side. There's not a lot of crawling stuff. Now, there are a lot of Jeep guys out there still that are slow, you know, want to do that. But the whole mentality, I'm not sure if it's like Busted Knuckle and Mad Ram, the YouTube channels, they've just kind of like, mentality of off-road in the East Coast is like, horsepower and speed, baby, just hit it, you know?
It's almost just like Widowmaker Hill Climb type, like stuff is what it looks like to me.
Yeah, yeah. But not everything is that way, obviously. Yeah. It's just the stuff that gets the views, and it rightfully so. It's awesome.
It's me. I'm the views. I like it.
Yeah. And people are like, oh, they need to air down. They'll crawl right up that stuff. You are crazy. Like, Cable Hill will, if you ever go and actually see Cable Hill in person, it's insane.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like,
I have seen people slowly crawl. Yeah. Yes. I have seen people slowly crawl Cable Hill, and it took about an hour.
Oh, my gosh.
Or something. Like, those rock bouncers can make it up in 10 seconds sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Do they deal with the land access issues out there the same way we do? Because my perception of it is that it's, these things are like, privately owned parks. So it's kind of whatever the landowner wants to do. Whereas out here, we have a lot of open land, which is good in some ways. And in other ways, like, it's not like we just can have some enthusiast that loves the sport that's like, you know what, I'm going to keep this park open forever as is, and people will always enjoy it. We do run into those conflicts where, you know, BLM doesn't work just for the off-road community. They're They're there for the Bureau of Land Management for the entirety of the country.
Right, yeah, so there is no, not that I've ever known or seen, but there is no BLM land out there.
Okay.
So everything that you're going to do at off-road parks, it's all privately owned parks. And sometimes they could be state-funded, or they could be like forest roads or okay. like forestry areas. And they have like a lease or something that they would get from the land where they could, you know, have riding access to it. So a lot of times I think of it just like a motocross track, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll have a motocross track on site with an off-road park.
Okay.
And so you have a motocross track and you have all these trails. So, and of course, insurance becomes the biggest play there, because the second some dummy didn't have their seatbelt on, no helmet, and they've been drinking, yep. you know, their fault, they're getting sued because of someone's reckless actions. And so, yeah, it's a hard part for keeping lands open and making sure, like, again, I've been at parks and I've seen people try and climb stuff, and I walk up to them and I said, dude, you don't even have a seatbelt on.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, I'm fine. I said, no, put a seatbelt on. And like, and then everybody kind of like would look at me at first. This was years ago when I used to do that. And now everybody is on everybody. People are wearing helmets, even just the little skull cap helmets. They're wearing them, the axle ones. And I love to see it, because at the end of the day, we want to go home to our families. Like, we can all have a good time, but we're not invincible.
Nope.
And so be as safe as possible. So the more we can do as enthusiasts protecting those people that are providing us land, it's really important. So. People don't understand that, I guess, because out here it's like, I mean, who are you going to sue, or who's the lawsuit going to go against? BLM, good luck, you know?
That's fine. I'll watch.
Yeah. So it's kind of like contradictory, because it's like, okay, you get these private landowners that are offering people to ride, they get in trouble, but like if we're on this BLM land, and I don't know, I've never experienced that kind of stuff, it just seems like they don't have any repercussion against them, the BLM. Like if somebody gets hurt, it's like, hey, so why can't that just carry over to a private landowner, you know? Like, you signed the waiver.
Yeah.
We don't have waivers to sign out here.
Yeah, that's kind of my thing, is like, I'm look, dude, like, if you go into this thinking that you're never going to get hurt or you're never going to have an issue, you don't understand what you're doing. Like, you don't understand what you're getting into, but.
Exactly.
Anyways, we just got to the top of the trail, man. I'm really excited we got to talk to you. You know, you probably had a good perspective. Anything people should check out other than your Instagram? Anything in particular?
I do most of my stuff on Instagram. I've tried to do some more Facebook stuff, and I've kind of made a commitment to start doing more YouTube, but everything is under MLEE211, M-L-E-E-211, across all platforms. So just check it out. We're going to be doing a lot more desert racing moving forward again this year. So we'll do King of the Hammers, and we're looking forward to all of that. See how everything goes.
Right on,
for
man.
The next couple of years. Appreciate everything.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for coming out. We'll catch you guys on the next one.